The place we left was Joseph having been dealt with by his brothers, right? They sold him to a Midianite caravan. The caravan went south, his brothers stayed, and his brothers went slightly south back home to dad and suffered him with a blood-stained, torn, fancy coat, cloak. Right in the middle of this, we get Genesis 38. This is a very hard tale. This is it's ugly. And it features Judah, of all people. Who's Judah? Fourth son, born to Leah, the lesser wife, but also the son that finally drew her acknowledgement of God's hand in her own life. Remember, the first three were given names that were absolute and a sister. They gave a ha. I foxed the AI. She was just completely targeting those names at her more loved sister. But the fourth one, she finally realizes God's got something going on here. This son I named Praise. That's what Judah's name means, Praise. So, yeah, he's got a great name. Came out of a good situation, kinda. After Joseph is legally declared dead, Judah leaves for the south. So he kind of splits away from his brothers. We have no idea why. We're just not told. But he goes back into part of the central hill country. He takes a wife, a Canaanite wife. All right, Abraham's rolling in his grave. And he settles into an area known as Kazib. I win again. oddly enough, that name is linked to the common linguistic root for deception. Is it any surprise in this family? Any surprise at all? No. We move on. Judah's wife, Shua. She bears three sons. You know, we've already had Desperate Housewives and the Dinah Show. Now we've got my three sons. For those of you that did not grow up with black and white 60s television sitcoms, no idea what that means. And that's okay. You're not missing a thing. And I don't know if they just couldn't figure out what the name the kid wanted. That word. Omen, little did they know, his name would become
famous.
Notorious. Famous, yes. And Shelah. Okay, three boys. Beauty. Judah properly finds a wife for his oldest son. This is dad's job. You know? Get a good wife for the first son, get the heir. Get the line continued, keep going, keep moving. This is his job.
Way to go, Judah.
Yeehaw. Problem. Right in the text. I know that ancient Hebrew did not use italics, but it may as well have. Is evil. We're right in the text. This is not a nice guy. He is an evil man. So, I killed him. Method, reason, not told. Just, God killed him. Oh, wow. Really? Yeah, you're evil, you're dead. Too bad that doesn't work nowadays, hey? No, because I've been on the freeway with some pretty evil people. I know I'm the only one with that issue. Culturally, Judah takes the proper next step. Okay? The eldest dies, leaving his wife without an heir, leaving the estate without a firstborn, an inheritor. Remember the Sadducees coming to Jesus with this question? One of us married a woman. He died childless. All seven died childless. And they're trying to trick him up. So in the resurrection, which they didn't even believe in, whose wife is it? Jesus did not, A, didn't fall for the trap, and B, said, are you not even aware of the scriptures? Boy, was that a slap in the face. I mean, big time. Because the Sadducees were known as the preservators of the text. They had it so well memorized, they used to play a dart game with a rolled scroll that was newly copied, therefore they had a good copy. They would throw a dart into the side of the scroll. Another Sadducee would unroll that thing, and everywhere there was a hole, he would read only that word. Finish the verse. You want to talk about pressure? Yeah, but they could do it. That's a scary thing. They knew those scrolls backwards and forwards, but they clearly didn't know. Anyway, culturally, Judah takes the next step. Judah gives Tamar, or his wife, to the next son in line. Not strange. This is culturally expected. The eldest dies without an heir. The wife must be married by the next brother in line, and he is to sire a child for her. There needs to be an heir. She needs to have one upon whom she can depend in her old age, a caretaker as it were, and the estate must have someone to carry on the name. Onan says, okay. He's lying through his tooth. Oh wait, he might not be a redneck, so maybe he's lying through his teeth. He does not buy in. And the text tells us why. Knowing the son will not belong to him, but to his brother, he cheats. Straight up, he cheats. He practices what's commonly known nowadays as coitus interruptus. I know. We're multiple centuries away from that. However, the term is common. Of course, it had a different name in the King James era. It was known as Onanism. Imagine that. He lent his name, not because it was cool, mostly because the Catholic Church approved of it as a birth control method. Kinda. He was trying to prevent a pregnancy, knowing full well that he did not get firstborn status if he provided a son. See, his big brother died. He's next. But if I sire a child, that kid bumps me. Yeah. Verse 9 makes it very clear this was deliberate. He knew exactly what he was doing. Knowing the offspring would not be his. Therefore, he prevented the impregnated getting her pregnant. Games. Games we play when trying to outwit God. say that with a straight face. You can't outwit God. Not appreciating this, God kills him too. Simple. Real simple. Okay, strike one, strike two, bam. So, Judah has a third son. Not yet of age, apparently. But he fears losing this kid too. He said, man, this lady is snake bit. The original black widow. Except she wasn't doing the consuming, God was. But for whatever reason, it's good thing you're a teenager, because we're going to put things on hold for a little bit. Tamar, go back to your father's home. Wait for him. When he is of age, we'll bring you two together. On the surface, that is 100% legit. The law of the land, born to be common practice, this is good. So she does. And she lives as a widow in her father's household, meaning she comes back under the umbrella of the father's authority. Spiritually, this principle has always been there. Man, leave father and mother, cleave to wife, become one flesh. He's the new umbrella over his wife, over his offspring. He is the new, I've heard it called, hedge builder. He is the one between God and his extension. Mm-hmm. Okay, she agrees. I'll go back under my father's hedge, under my father's protection relationship, and I will live as a widow. Essentially, live as if she were betrothed, because she was. Legally, contractually, she interacted with other women, not men. Socially, she couldn't flirt. I don't know how much of that went on, but she's very much in the status Mary was, betrothed to her husband Joseph, not yet married, and suddenly she's pregnant. We've seen this before. Scripturally, in the course of time, Judah's wife dies. Okay?
Great.
Life moves on. He attends to normal business. He's a herder. So, shearing time happens. Yep. I'll go out and pretend I know what I'm doing, and hopefully the foreman let me hang around. I have no idea what kind of reality that had. But he goes, he's accompanied by a local friend, a Canaanite, Abdullah. Goes out, doing the thing to the flocks. Okay, he's up in that area. Well, this is close enough, apparently, to Tamar's father's household. She finds out he's coming. Hey, your father-in-law's on the way. Enough years have gone by. She is beginning to suspect. I still don't have a husband. This kid's grown now. We're not told how old, but we are told that he's of age. Still hasn't been given. Either direction. He hasn't been given to her, she hasn't been given to him. Judah has broken his promise. Her brain kicks in. I have an idea. Yeah, and it's not forward because it certainly wasn't a better idea, but it was a necessary idea. She dresses as a harlot. Excuse me. Well, there was a way that identified them, either as a cultic priestess, as a ritual temple virgin, or as a streetwalker. That's the only way to put it. She dresses as part of the local temple connected worship aids. And in a fertility cult, the worship aid is always sexual in nature, both male and female. And that's what the Canaanite cults were. They were fertility cults. Your one of your acts of worship, in addition to monetary or sacrificial animals, was to commit the sex act with one of the temple prostitutes, because that was supposed to get the gods in the mood to be fertile, thereby increasing your crops, increasing your herds, increasing your family. You can't make this stuff up. But they did. But we also know where it came from. It came from the original sons of God that intermarried with the sons of men, daughters of men. They're the ones who taught them how to do all this stuff. So, she sets up beside the road, probably the main throughway. Most people travel this, he's going up, he's going to share. She is open for business. She didn't hang a shingle. Her dress, her veil, her bangles, her wrist stuff. This was a communication enough. This is what I do for a living. I belong to whatever cult. Judah arrives at her corner. All right. My wife just died. A harlot. Just what I need. Want. Let's make that clear. See, desire, take. Biblical pattern of the road to sin, right? See, desire, take. Not need. Need doesn't happen. So he negotiates a price with her. She was smart enough to realize it was not a stain. It was not a plainclothes officer. It was just Judith. She knew him. She is a veiled, unrecognizable woman. This much of her face is showing. He's clueless. They agree on price. She is a shrewd enough woman to say, all right, you're going to give me a young goat. Where is it? Well, I'll have to send somebody back to the herd to get it for him. You think it was born yesterday? Really? What will you give me to guarantee me my goat? Ah. Okay. What will assure you? Now, Judah would have been dressed as one of a wealthy landowner, herder class of people, which included a better category of clothing, robing, undergarments, etc. Probably included a ring or seven. It included a fancier walking stick, usually. It also included a well-worked cord around his neck with a signet on it. And that is not a baby swan. So she looks at it. Yeah, I think your signet and your cord and your walking stick, that'll do. Because she knows no self-respecting landowner is going to leave those in her hands. She's guaranteed getting her goat. She was actually after her kid. Sorry. Judah agrees. The transaction is closed. The business is done. Everyone walks away content. Right?
She is a good negotiator.
Yes. Cue the dramatic music. Take your pick. Dragnet, theme from Jaws, Imperial March. I found this fun little thing of a signet. It was a fire-hardened clay cylinder, miniature, maybe about that big, worn around the neck on a fancy cord. The more wealthy you were, the fancier the cord. This is what it looked like. And when a document was signed or a transaction was completed, a piece of damp clay was laid out, and then you take this and you roll your hand over it, and this is the impression that results. That is the finest autograph of the day. If he had been any more famous, it could have been sold by a collector for millions. I don't know what your autographs are worth like a baseball. You got a baseball with autographs, but I can't read them, so I can't tell you, but you know. But that's what she took. This is huge. That's his driver's license, his passport, and his social security number all rolled into one.
Reminds me of the old credit card sliders.
Exactly. You know, We went, last time I visited my daughter down in Florida, we drove upstate, and we went through this little hamlet, and there was this little sign about milkshakes, and everybody goes, oh, yes. And oddly enough, her car just forced its way into the parking lot. And she's going, I can't stop it. Well, they had one of those.
Wow.
This nothing map dot in north central Florida, and they've got the old credit card reader. And she looked at it, she goes, really? I don't have an embossed credit card. So they entered it by hand. They wrote it on one of the flimsies. I'm going, wow, I just stepped back 40 years. Of course, my daughter couldn't remember that. She won't be, well, she just turned 37. So after all this is done, Judy gets back with the shearers. She goes back to her life of anonymity. He sends his local friend back. He says, by the way, I owe the temple hauler down the road, I owe her a goat. Take this goat down and get my stuff back. So he takes the goat. Can't find her. So he starts asking around. Harlot? What Harlot? I ain't been a harlot in these places for years. Judah, whatever, okay, better keep it. I mean, this is now potentially embarrassing. He's got his full ID kit somewhere floating around. Doesn't even know if it's in the criminal element or not. It's better that she keep it and all of this stays quiet. That way I don't bear the shame of having to admit that, you know, I'm doing this. Word comes to Judah, roughly 3 months later, we're told scripturally, hey, you know your daughter-in-law? She's pregnant. Danger, Will Robinson, danger. Does not compute. Okay, puts on his mantle of authority. Bring her out, we'll burn her. Excuse me? No, that's... That was common. You didn't burn a witch, but you burned an adulterous woman. Says nothing about the guy. Tamar receives a summons and she sends back a message. Yeah, the owner of these three items, that's Daddy. Judas looking at this going, uh-oh. Yeah, he is so caught out, it's not funny. Yesterday I'm working a baseball game. Bases are loaded, a single out. This guy hits a driving, hooping line drive. The right fielder, full out, dives about this far off the ground. His whole body is horizontal. Plop! The runners had assumed there's no way he's getting it. He gets to his feet and he's got about an 80-foot throw to first base, and that runner is almost to second. And he just turns and he stops and he sat down. It's like, I'm dead. And he was. I mean, they doubled him off the base. But just his whole posture was like, ugh. That's Judah. He is caught. There is nothing he can do about it. And you know he's going to be called out. Well, he was. Avoid the shame? Good plan, Judah. How'd that work out? Now everybody knows the story. Not a prayer. Not a prayer. First thing that he really does right here, that's on me. That's on me. Couple of different ways. A, I didn't bring Tamar and Shelah together when I should have. Made a promise, I broke it. I'm paying for it, big time. B, not only did I mess up, I impregnated her. Can't refute that. He declares her more righteous. You are more righteous than I in these matters. Yup. Then he did another thing right. He remained completely aloof from her sexually. He may be a lot of things, but he was not going to be involved in an incestuous relationship. Not by blood, but by law. She was his daughter-in-law. Pops into mind the Corinthian church where Paul in chapter 5 is just stunned. You people are proud of the fact that a man has his father's wife. Judah wasn't going there. He was not going there. This is necessary. And you know, when you first read through this, you're going, what? Why is this recorded? It set a single family in motion. Because of the two, she had twins in her womb, one of them, Perez, direct line ancestor of Jesus Christ. We are told that in Matthew 1. Had to happen. Really? Wow. But you know what? I've said it before, and I suspect you'll say it again until you're probably sick of it. When God writes the notes, the symphony is unbelievable. Not only in its complexity, but in its power. All of that happened so that the line of Judah would perpetuate, because remember, his wife died, and two of his sons were killed directly by God because they were anathema to him. Shelah did not figure anywhere in it. We're not even told if they married. We can operate on the assumption, but it wasn't significant scripturally. So ends this weird chapter. Now, meanwhile, back in the Joseph ranch, he's in Egypt. I know, I see the looks at the clock. How are we going to do this? We'll go to Egypt. We'll figure it out from there.
What happened to the other twin?
We're not told. He was completely insignificant. Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
That was not working today. Twins. And yet, even Jacob and Esau were significant. You know? It's like, wow. Nothing. There is absolutely no further mention anywhere in Scripture about him. Even the extra-biblical historians who collated ancient Jewish documents, nothing. Herodotus, Josephus, nothing. And part of us says, wow, what a head scratcher. And the other part of us realizes, well, that's just how God works. He moves to make things happen the way they have to happen. And we are called to lead, follow, or get out of the way. Walt, you had something.
Well, I'm just going to ask, has there been no significance to the scarlet thread that was tied around?
Yeah.
They kind of put a lot of stuff in here that...
They put stuff in here, and they're all in that category of things that make you go, right? Yeah. And it's... Yes, you can read commentators that will speculate on that. I guarantee you it is speculation. And it's one of those where I'm, you know, going through and looking, sifting and going, let that fall through. But if you'd like, I could dig more out. I can't do it now, but I could. Anyway, we spend the rest of Joseph in Genesis. We spend the rest of Genesis in Joseph. Get that right, yeah. So, beginning with his sale to the Israelites, or to Potiphar, excuse me. Potiphar bought him from Ishmaelites. And yet it was a Midianite caravan. They're descendants of Ishmael. The ones who lived in enmity with their brothers. Yeah, kind of worked. Did they even know who this kid was they bought? Good chance they didn't. Just like, strapping young lad. Got a future in him. He knows how to walk. He knows how to work. We'll get something out of him. And then the text changes focus. The Lord is with Joseph. Everything he did, God caused it to prosper. This is a narrative about Joseph, but the focus is on the actions of God. And I think, you know what? When I think of the narrative of my own life, way too often I'm the star. Well, at least a supporting cast. Probably wouldn't win an Oscar, but I am the focus. Scripture shows us clearly God is the focus. We are either acting in accord with Him, or as Pastor pointed out so eloquently this morning, walking or running away from Him. All that Joseph did, God caused it to prosper. The narrative makes it sound like he's barely in the household of Potiphar before Potiphar figures out there's something special about this young guy. Really special. Gave him enough authority, bit by bit by bit. Pretty soon, Joseph is the chief steward. The head guy in the house, with the exception of the head of the house, trusts him completely. Text even has a little fun with this. Everything Joseph oversaw, and that didn't, household, farming, business, interests, everything he touched went well, prospered. Potiphar got the blessing by association. The only thing he worried about, we're told right in the text, his only daily concern was, his only concern was his daily food. What do I put in my mouth? That's all I have to worry about, because this guy is good. This guy has a God on his side, clearly. Mere mortals can't be this way. Then there's this little side note. Yeah, Joseph was good looking. Maybe a little too good looking. Potiphar's wife noticed. Here's another one of those moments. She tries to get Joseph into her bed. I have no idea if this was normal in a wealthy Egyptian's household. We don't have a lot of extra biblical sources to look at and say, oh yeah, it was a hotbed of intrigue and illicit liaisons. Nah, not there. Joseph refuses, and he lays it out, three reasons. First of all, my master, your husband, knows nothing about this. My master trusts me with everything in the house, except you. Nothing is held back from me but his wife. Buy a clue, lady. Buy a vowel? I don't know. Where's Vanna when we need her? How then, and this is the kicker, how then can I sin against God? Yeah, there's physical reasons, and I'll give them to you first, lady. You're going behind your master, your husband's back. He has no knowledge of this. That's wrong. Secondly, everything in this household is under my jurisdiction with the exception of you. That's wrong if I act on that. And if you don't want to listen to that, there is a God bigger than all of us. If I act on this with you, I am sinning against Him. Can't do that. You ever bump into think from early teens forward into about your mid-20s. You ever have any kind of friend relationships or peer relationships where they're saying, oh yeah, let's do this. My parents don't want me to. Oh, that went over big. I don't feel like it. Chicken? That would be a sin against God. Ha! Oh, you're one of those, huh? You're an idiot. And you are not part of us anymore. A lot of pressure. And I'm not talking modern American teens. It doesn't seem to matter. Any teen, anywhere, has to go through this gamut. He may not be a teen. He might be into his early 20s at this point. But his most telling final argument is, nope, that goes against God. It's not his master. He's worried about offending. It's his master. All caps, master. Yeah.
It's interesting that even hypothetically, if Potiphar had said to Joseph, yeah, you can have my wife also, it seems like Joseph would have said, no thanks.
You do get this idea because everything Joseph did, God is with him. Everything he does, God causes to prosper. Joseph knows exactly upon which side his bread is boiled. They didn't do butter in it all. But yeah, you get the feeling that he had the hand of God already on his heart so firmly, he's not going to go there. And he makes it clear to him, I'm not going there. This lady is nothing if not persistent. And here we go back to this idea of, you know, Satan tore a little page out of Revelation. Behold, I stand at the door and pick the lock. He's not going to smash it in, but he is going to wear you down. Pick, 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 pick. Like that water drip in the sink. It keeps you awake until 3 a.m. Pick, 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 she insists, every day. Hey, yeah, I put lady in quotation marks because this is not the sign of a lady.
Nope.
Joseph ignores her. Ooh, ooh, you want to really burn somebody? Don't pay any attention. Don't pay any attention. That had to just rot her socks. Well, sandals. I doubt she wore socks in the hot climate. So, one day she catches him alone in the house. He's doing chief steward stuff in there. She's doing who knows what. Stalking the chief steward? We don't know. She grabs him. You must lie with me. You ever play those games as a kid where you're chasing, 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 and somebody grabs all of you and you shoot your arms out of the coat or the whatever, and off you go, and they're left hanging? That's exactly what she does. He slips, takes off, she goes. Curses, foiled again. Not really. Ooh, I can use this. So she walks over, sets up the tableau, probably leaves the coat on the floor right there. Couldn't have been very enthusiastic. Just enough to get the attention of the household servants. Because he slipped closely, now she is a resentful, spurned, ignored woman. Is that a recipe for disaster? Doesn't have to be, I mean, the gender really doesn't matter. Yeah, it was. So she spins a tale to the other servants. This Hebrew tried to rape me. Got his cloak right here as proof. As soon as I screamed, really? Mistress? We didn't hear that. Because it didn't happen. So, she keeps close, waits for hubby to get home. Yeah, you're going to get it when dad gets home. Potiphar comes back in from doing Potiphar-type stuff, captain of the guard stuff, whatever, you know, palace functionary. High enough official, he's probably in meetings all going along. They're administrating. He's administrating. She tells the extremely tall tale. We're told he's angry about it. The word used is not furious, upset, outraged. It's irked. That's a better... That was rude. Kind of a reaction. Now, we do know Egyptian law of the time, a slave attempts to rape a free woman? Automatic. No questions asked. No judge, no jury, no trial. Yeah.
I don't know where I read it. It may have been
in one of the Hebrew school things. And what it said was, when Potiphar's wife told him the tale, and he was angry, but he knew his wife's, it wasn't Joseph, it was his wife, and that's why, instead of him getting a death sentence, he put him in prison, to satisfy his wife, but yet not to take Joseph's life.
Exactly, but look at his appearance, Virginia, please.
Why didn't Joseph tell Pharaoh what was happening between him and the wife?
Why did he tell Pharaoh? He's a slave.
Oh, okay.
He's a slave. He can say, mm-hmm. but his word does not mean as much as a free person.
Oh, okay.
That even though the household was entrusted to his care, he was to administrate it, he was to care for it, he was to oversee. David?
Is this where we get the thought that hell hath no fury like a woman's born?
You're right. It certainly wasn't original to Shakespeare, was it?
It's an American nighttime drama.
Hey,
wealthy man, loose wife, pool boy comes.
Yep. Yep, that gardener didn't stand a chance, did he? But now, he's on the hook. Well, with this, hell hath no fury. Yeah, she was spurned. She was ignored. She was really in an agitated state about this, and now she's got a way to get back. But like Leonard was saying, Potiphar merely imprisoned him. He could have just sent him out back and had one of the guys from the jail come over with a machete. Make Joseph a head shorter. Because he really, even as a trusted, responsible slave, he didn't have any rights. But he puts him in the king's prison. Who is Potiphar? His office is captain of the guard, i.e., in charge of the prisons. Huh. But the king's prison was for minor offenders. They did something to the crown that threw off his groove, so to speak. And this is where Joseph ends up. Oh, did Potiphar know something about his wife?
Yes.
It's not clear in scripture, but some things to think about. Captain the king guard puts him in minimum security. This is white sheets. This is Martha Stewart. The proper protocol was to kill Joe. Seth didn't fit on the line. No death sentence. He knows this man is under God's favor. Minor prison, not a dungeon of deprivation. Guys chained to the wall, water leaking. Rats nibbling toes, all that stuff, uh-uh. Did he know his wife was lying? We're not told.
I think so.
Yeah. Did he suspect something? We certainly suspect so. Did she have a history? We don't know.
Yeah.
We are not told. That's where we got to stop because we're done with time. But this is thought-provoking because Joseph landed on his feet. His brothers decided not to kill him. That was a choice, convinced by Reuben. But they certainly got him out of their collective hair. Probably a 6 or 7 day journey south into an enemy kingdom. He landed on his feet. Except now he's landed in prison. Oh, but it's a minimum security thing. We'll leave him there. He won't languish. We'll return next week, and we'll find out.